Good morning and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We are only going to have one argument this morning, and I will ask the court to go ahead and call it. Aguilar, were you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your opponent is not present, but you've elected to go ahead and present an argument, right?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe I'll keep it very brief without Mr. Blue here to argue his side.
That's up to you.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
The first point I'd like to make is that a lot of our briefing dealt with the issue of whether or not the agreement between counsel as to the temporary injunction resulted in waiver and estoppel of any alleged error in the order. Before going into that, I'll just point out that, and I'm sure the court is aware, last week we filed a supplemental brief containing an amended order to the amended order to the injunction, which contained a trial date in the order. Now, one of the main points that opposing counsel was making was that the lack of a trial date in the injunction order rendered it void under Rule 683. As set forth in that supplemental brief we filed, the court was within its jurisdiction to add that one line as to the trial date, and there's case law directly on point stating that it's within that the trial court's jurisdiction to add the date, and that does not affect this court's jurisdiction to rule on the remaining merits of the case. And because that trial date has been entered in there, that nullifies the primary point related to Rule 683 as to any alleged procedural defects in the order.
I haven't seen that order. I saw the supplemental brief, though. Is that order does it look identical to the prior order in that it is approved as to form only by the attorneys, or what is stated in that order with regard to the agreement or lack of agreement between the parties?
The most recent order before the court that I'm referring to, it's
April. Wasn't it an April order?
Yes, Justice Sellers. Mm-hmm. It's identical to the previous order. Contains all the same language except a final sentence setting the case for trial. All the language before that is exactly the same.
And at the very end, it's approved only as to form as well?
Yes, it mentions it's approved only as to form.
Is it signed by the attorneys?
Yes, Your Honor. It's signed by both attorneys. And as to language in there regarding agreement or lack of an agreement, the first paragraph of the order, as in the prior order, mentions that it's based on the argument of counsel and the subsequent agreement of counsel. Mm-hmm. And that has not been altered in any way in this most recent order.
Was there a reason why you waited until Friday before oral argument to file that amended brief to point this out to the court's attention?
We were waiting on a copy of it from the clerk. Any delay beyond that was not intentional, and I apologize if it came to the court just recently.
I have a question. In the TRO, the amount that they were allowed to spend was $5,000, and in reading the record from the first hearing, at the conclusion of the hearing, that was brought to Judge Fostell's attention, and he said, well, y'all go talk and see what the right amount is, and if you can't come up with one, I'll come up with one. And then the next thing that's in there is this order that says they can spend $12,000 a month. I have to, and then there's not any other court reporter's record or any other thing to explain that. Was that an agreement?
Yes, Your Honor. There was discussion between counsel, and all this was agreed to between counsel. Granted, those discussions do not appear on the record. We concede that.
There's not even a recitation of the agreement on the record, is there? You had apparently had some discussions, but then they weren't even embodied onto the, they weren't even dictated into the record.
That is correct, Your Honor, that the precise terms of the agreement were not read into the record.
And what concerns me is that if you don't dictate the terms into the record, and then the court issues an order, and it says something about an agreement in it, but then the parties sign it as to form only, how do we know what the agreement was? There's no record of it, and there is no order, agreed order, where the attorneys are agreeing to the terms. And it's very sparse in the record as to what all the terms are going to be, even what's dictated by the judge. And I'm having a really difficult time figuring out what that agreement was from the record itself. Is there something missing from the record, or is this all we've got?
I don't believe there are parts of the record that the court has. I believe that's all that was taken down by the reporter. And, I mean, I'll concede it is sparse. Could more detail have been put in there? Certainly. But we believe that, I mean, based on the recitation in the order and the lack of any objections at the hearing from either side, the statement by counsel after the court issued his ruling that, quote, that's acceptable to the Morrisons, we believe that, you know, viewing all the evidence in the record in favor of the trial court's ruling, that there's enough evidence in there to show that there was, in fact, an agreement.
Thank you.
And as to the objections to the scope of the injunction, we have significant briefing in the briefs as to the Gatlin case, which we believe is right there on point. It's a case with highly similar facts. A trusted friend becomes a financial advisor. That advisor then embezzles funds, unbeknownst to the fiduciary, to the party which the advisor is a fiduciary for. After that's discovered, the court issues an injunction, you know, setting a limit on the assets that can be disposed of, and even forbids destroying any documents related to those assets, just like we have in this case. And the Gatlin case cites to the Manexa case, which is another similar case with similar facts. Fiduciary parties are embezzling funds, and the court allows a monetary cap on funds that can be disposed of prior to trial. And the court notes that this is in both Gatlin and Manexa. A legal remedy may be considered inadequate when there's a danger that the defendant's funds will be reduced or diverted pending trial. The mere existence of a remedy at law is not grounds for denial of an injunction of injunctive relief unless the remedy is as practical and efficient to the ends of justice as an equitable remedy. And that goes to the argument of the opposing party that, well, Ms. Gage is seeking monetary damages. That means she has an adequate remedy, so there doesn't need to be any type of monetary cap in the injunction. And that position ignores the Gatlin case, ignores the Manexa case, that while money damages can certainly be an adequate legal remedy, under circumstances the court can find that the risk of dissipation of assets renders it inadequate, and an injunction can be issued limiting the dissipation of those assets.
One concern I have about the scope of the injunction is that, well, the cases that were cited by the appellant I thought were distinguishable because most of those cases said that what was being frozen, so to speak, did not relate to the basis of the lawsuit. And this account from the exhibits that were, or an account from the exhibits that were admitted at the first hearing showed these transfers. But I don't see that this injunction limits the them disposing of their assets that are only in that account. It limits, other than cattle, from disposing of any asset except for the $12,000. How is that not a problem?
Also cited in the Gatlin case addresses when assets are commingled, when a fiduciary takes assets without permission, and
that's why I'm not having a problem. I'm saying, for argument's sake, there might not be a problem with that account because that was commingled from the exhibits. But what about, I mean, if they have five other accounts, they're prohibited from disposing of those assets as well. And there's no evidence of commingling with those five other accounts.
In Ms. Gage's affidavit testimony presented with the application, she stated that Marsha Gage had access, that Marsha Morrison had access, I mean, not just to the accounts, but to, you know, other property in general, which, you know, could have been disposed of by her outside of just the bank account.
Is that in the record?
It's in the Gage affidavit attached to the petition.
Oh, okay. But it wasn't introduced at the hearing.
No, Your Honor, I believe it was not.
Is there actually any evidence in the record that we have before us that there was embezzlement? We have a bunch of documents that were admitted into evidence showing some transfers, but we don't have any testimony saying that that those transfers weren't authorized, do we?
Your Honor, I would look to the affidavit testimony attached to the petition. While it was not entered at the hearing and that testimony was not given live at the hearing, the trial court can consider the affidavits attached to an application when there's no objection by either party to it, and there were no objections issued by anyone in this case.
You have some authority for that?
I'm looking through for it here in my notes.
I understand the court can do that on a TRO, but for a temporary injunction hearing, I think the court is bound by the evidence that's presented, and I didn't see any evidence of lack of authorization to make those transfers.
I'm looking for that case citation for you here, Your Honor.
Had you offered that affidavit into evidence and it had not been objected to, then it would be probative for everything because it's an objected to hearsay, which then is probative as to everything that's in it. But I didn't see that it was even offered into evidence.
And I believe you're right there, Judge. I mean, it was presented with the application, it was not offered into evidence. I can't seem to find that citation here. But, I mean, considering, and we would also just fall back again on the agreement to the injunction, you know, as say in the Hinkey case and several other cases cited in the brief, you know, when the other side agrees to an order, a judgment, or an injunction, you know, they're bound by that, they waive any alleged error.
Well, I have a question then. What about their argument that it is essentially a pre-judgment attachment of their assets?
And I would look.
Okay, go ahead.
Excuse me. I would look again to the Gatlin case, the Menexa case, and the cases cited within those cases regarding limits set on dissipation of assets before trial. I mean, they've characterized it as a pretrial collection attempt, but, you know, as those cases say, I mean, if the court finds that there's a danger assets will be dissipated, taken outside the prospect of collection, the court can find that that makes it an inadequate legal remedy, not as a pre-judgment collection, but in just taking a 10,000-foot view of what's happening and saying, like, well, if the defendant's allowed to have a free reign to dispose of assets, that makes even a money judgment an inadequate legal remedy. So while they view it from one side to saying, like, well, hey, that's just a post-judgment collection, you know, viewed in light of Gatlin and Manexa, it's just to avoid having an inadequate remedy at law.
Well, wouldn't that generally be true in every case seeking damages? What sets this case apart? Was there evidence at the hearing of a risk of absconding or transferring assets if the temporary injunction was not entered?
And I mean, I would point to the affidavit testimony, which we've already addressed. I mean, there is testimony that the Morrisons have been buying, you know, property out of state, testimony as to the amounts taken. And as to your question as to, in every case, people are seeking a money judgment. Why not just enjoin transfers of every single defendant? On page 567 of Manexa, the court addresses that question. The fact that damages may be subject to the most precise calculation becomes irrelevant if the defendants in a case are permitted to dissipate specific funds that would otherwise be available to pay a money judgment. Our holding does not mean that a party may be enjoined from utilizing funds in his possession any time a suit is brought against him. However, such a restraint is warranted in this case, since all the funds in question were provided by the plaintiffs and other members of their class. Some of these funds have allegedly been dissipated by fiduciaries holding them, while the fiduciaries are seeking to place the remaining funds beyond the jurisdiction of the Texas court. In that case, there were transfers from a fiduciary to a company held by insiders and other transfers along down the line. And the Manexa court looked at that in the totality of the circumstances and saw that, well, even though they are just seeking a money judgment, in our opinion, it looks like unless we enjoin those transfers, there'll be nothing left at the end.
Okay. Any more questions? Well, thank you, counsel, for your argument and for showing up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your case is submitted, and you're excused. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will adjourn for the day at this time.